Les colloques du Collège de France.
Okay, welcome back. Last talk of this conference. We're very happy to introduce David Papineau from King's College London for a talk entitled Problems with Revelation. The floor is yours, David.
Thank you. And are we all here? Good. Before I start, I'd just like to say this is now the end of the week of indexicality. Some of us have been here for 5 days now to workshop on indexical dynamics, and now this conference, and it's been terrific. I've been able to hang out with a lot of old friends and make some good new friends, and apart from that, the conferences have both been very, very focused, organized, and I've learned a huge amount. So thanks from all the speakers and everybody else, I hope, to Francois and Marianne and Gregor and Julian. Thank you very much. Good, okay. Problems with revelation. So this is going to be kind of a big picture talk. This one? Click here, this will work. That's good. I'm gonna survey the last half century of arguments about physicalism, about consciousness, and note in particular where various transparency ideas come into it. And as you might expect, I'm going to argue that these debates haven't produced any good arguments against physicalism. They might have some sound and valid arguments, but they assume what they're intending to prove, and that's what I'm going to show you. So here's the plan. It's the introduction, which is what you just heard. I'm going to frame the issue by making two background points that I won't really argue for. Then I'll look at the knowledge argument, two-dimensional arguments against physicalism. And then I'll switch to what I think of as a new wave of anti-physicalist arguments that focus in particular on what's going on in phenomenal thinking, and I'll be looking at two versions of that. What's going on in conceptual reflection with phenomenal concepts, and what's going on in phenomenal introspection. And that will be the end. So one background point, which somehow gets lost when people are saying, do we have a good argument against physicalism? And no, you don't. And on the other side, there's compelling arguments for physicalism. And that, for me, frames the issue. Default is that physicalism is right, and we need to have strong reasons to deny it. And the argument is familiar. I'm not going to go into it. I'm not going to try and defend it. It kind of follows from the causal closure of the physical realm. It looks like all physical goings on have full physical causes, and that leaves no room for conscious states that aren't physical to make a causal difference. And that really squeezes the room for people who want to be dualists. So just remember that's in the background. Second point I want to take as given is that physicalism is highly counterintuitive about consciousness. The idea that this feeling I'm having is just neurons firing strikes everybody, surely that's wrong. Surely the feeling is something extra. And I don't want to deny that there is a very powerful intuition to that effect. I mean, it comes out when you ask, could there be a zombie? Everybody, including dyed-in-the-wool physicalists, their first thought is, sure. And then you realize that, well, if you're a physicalist, there's just one thing there. What does it mean to say there could be a zombie? But the first thought is, yeah, that makes kind of sense. The possibility makes sense. And that's already a dualist thought. And the kind of existence of this intuition will pop up at various points in my talk. Let me say a little bit more about the intuition. Martina said that, you know, in philosophy we have to pay attention to intuitions. I'm all for paying attention to intuitions. Intuitions can mess us up in all kinds of ways, but I really don't think the existence of an intuition per se is an argument or the start of an argument, or even necessarily evidence for the view claimed by the intuition. And in this particular case, there's pretty strong reason to think that the existence of an intuition in favor of dualism, called intuition distinctness, dualist intuition, is not evidence for the truth of dualism. Whether some phenomenon is evidence for some theory depends on whether that phenomenon is more likely given that theory than the alternative theories. And if you think about it, the intuition of dualism, at least to the extent it's something that is expressed in people's inclinations to say various things and so on, isn't going to be any more likely on standard versions of dualism than on physicalism. I think these are versions of dualism, which are the standard ones, that respect the causal closure of the physical. So you could be an epiphenomenist, or you could be a Rossinian monist, but on neither of those views do conscious facts make any extra causal difference relative to the physical facts. So whatever explanation for the intuition of dualism is given by a physicalist, it's going to be mimicked by these dualist theories. They're going to have to explain the intuition of dualism, my inclination to say various dualist things, in just the same way as the physicalists do. So it's an interesting question. What exactly is the explanation of the intuition of dualism? I mean, outside philosophy, there are evolutionary anthropologists and psychologists who take seriously, why is it people are so inclined to be dualist? Thinking that this is a bad idea. And there's a debate about why people are intuitively dualist, but we don't have to go into that now. It's an interesting question. We can discuss it in the discussion time if we like, but main point here is that whatever explanation is given is going to be available to a physicalist. So, put intuition to one side for the moment, and let's ask, are there any good arguments against physicalism? And I'll start with Frank Jackson's knowledge argument. You might ask, why am I starting with Frank Jackson? Why don't I start with Kripke? I mean, that will really take us back half a century, 1980, back to the original lecture, 1970. But Kripke's argument, it's a complicated business. I'll come back to that. Leave that for a minute. Let's just start with bog standard Frank Jackson knowledge argument. Mary knew all the P facts. She learns a new fact. Some facts are not P. P for physical. Now, is this a good argument? Various ways of resisting it. Type A physicalists, a priori physicalists, will deny that there's any sense in which true is true. Cotty's been pushing me on this last few days. I think that's a very hard line to run, particularly in connection with the Mariana case and color experience facts. It's very hard to deny that there's some sense in which Mary knows something. Mariana, in particular, knows something she didn't know before. And it would be enough for the anti-physicalist just to have this argument applying in that particular case. So I'm not going to run that way. I'm going to be a type B physicalist. So type B physicalist, a posteriori physicalist, says that Jackson only shows us that there's something new at the level of concepts, not that there's anything new in reality. What happens is Mary acquires a new concept, and so she can think that tomatoes cause this thing in a new way. She can think that we'll express it as it causes this feeling, when she used to think it caused a certain activity in V4. But at the level of reality, this is just the same fact being referred to by two different concepts. The activity in V4 and the experiences of visualizing red are just one and the same thing. There's just one property there. I like to think of it like a property, as a property, like Martina does. There's something a bit funny if you think back about the history. Why did Jackson think he had a persuasive argument against physicalism? We need some water. Have we got some? Got some water. I'll back up so I drink out of this. The idea that you can have two terms that refer to the same thing is scarcely unfamiliar to philosophers. So why, I mean, and people responded to Jackson's argument in that way very quickly. Why did he think it was a persuasive argument? And in fact, he was quite right to think it was a persuasive argument, and the reason is that prior to the Mary argument, all physicalists were a priori physicalists. They thought that our only concepts of mental states, in general, and conscious states in particular, were role concepts, kind of analytic functionalism, sophisticated behaviorism. And so ideas you have in Wittgenstein, Ryle, and interestingly in philosophers of mind of a slightly more advanced generation than me. David Lewis and Dan Dennett have never given up the idea that our only concepts of mental states are role concepts. The concept of a state that plays a certain causal role. And on that view, the physical facts determine the conscious facts, but they determine them a priori. If you've got all the physical facts, then given your grasp of the concept of seeing red or being in pain, you can infer all the facts. You can infer who is in pain, when, and so on. And I take Jackson to refute this view. And interesting, I'm going to go back to Kripke now. Prior to Jackson, there was a standard response to Kripke. I can just about remember this. In the late 70s, Kripke was taken to have shown that C fibers and yet no pains is both conceptually and metaphysically possible. That's what he was taken to have shown. And many people, classically Richard Boyd in the introduction to the functionalism section in Readings in Philosophy of Psychology, Volume 1, said, yes, well, C fibers but no pain, that's possible whichever way you count possibility. But that's only because it's possible that C fibers might not play the pain role. They're possible worlds in which there are people writhing around and trying to get away from it, and they don't have no C-fibers. That's why it's possible. Or the other way around. There are people who have C-fibers and it doesn't make them writhe around and so on. That's why it's possible to have C-fibers but no pain. But Boyd said, that's no argument against physicalism because it's not possible that you could be writhing around, etc., and not be in pain. But this view can't withstand Jackson's argument. Mary, we can take her to know that maybe herself in the future has C-fibers firing, whatever's going on in her brain, and is riding around and so on. She knows all that, but she still doesn't know what it's like to be in that situation. So there, we have the post-Jackson, an alternative way of being a physicalist. We say, there's two concepts of pain. Phenomenal concept Mary acquires or somebody acquires from being in pain. And then physical concepts of pain might be a role concept, might be a directly referring physical concept. And the one without the other is conceptually possible. These are two distinct concepts, but not metaphysically possible. The identity, I'll stick to pains and C-fibers just because it's faulted it. It's slightly embarrassing for grown-up people to be using this silly example, but it's easier to talk like that. And not have pain equals having some state which makes you ride around and so on, but the arguments would all go the same, either way. We have two terms for one thing. It's true that there's one thing, it's necessary, but that it's true is an a posteriori matter. Okay, at this point, we get a second wave of anti-physicalist arguments. And this says, there's plenty of cases where you have a posteriori necessities, but you can't have a posteriori necessities involving phenomenal concepts. And the argument is that phenomenal concepts are special in a way that stops necessities involving them being a posteriori. So the thought is going to be, if you had an identity involving a phenomenal concept, then it would be a priori if it was true. But it's not a priori, so it can't be true. And this argument was developed within the framework of two-dimensional semantics, and we can say a lot about that, and there's a lot of complicated apparatus, but let me try and keep it simple. The idea is that most terms have a secondary intention. What they refer to, keep on referring to cross-modal space, and they have a primary intention, which is, think paradigmatically, of a reference-fixing contingent description. So that term, with that description, would refer to different things in different possible worlds, taken as actual, but it refers to what it does in the actual world. And the thought is that terms like that, they're kind of indirect. You're kind of getting at the referent via the primary intention, via the description. And then the thought is, to make the two-dimensional argument intuitive, that's why we can't see necessities a priori. It's because we're thinking about the thing in question at second hand, and the fact we're thinking at second hand obscures the identity from us. And then the thought is that phenomenal concepts don't refer like that. Phenomenal concepts don't have a primary intention different from the secondary intention. They don't refer in virtue of some description. They refer directly. And I mean, the type B physicists will give you some story about how they refer directly. That's off the page for now. But the thought is, think of them. They're like million names. And then the two-dimensional argument is, well, given that, surely we ought to be able to see that the identity is true if it is true. Okay, I'm assuming here that the thing on the right-hand side, the physical term, C-fibers firing, is also a million name. And you can question that, and that takes you off in the direction of Resilient monism. But let's not go there. Let's just focus on the phenomenal concept side. I want to digress for a little bit. And this is a pet topic of mine, and I'd be curious if anybody wants to ask about it in the discussion. Two dimensions, people who run this kind of general semantic framework and use it to argue against physicalism in this way, standardly say this is Kripke's invention. Kripke invented two-dimensional semantics, and look, at the end of naming necessity, here he runs this argument against physicalism. And I mean, people say that. I used to say it. In fact, my 2003 book, I attribute this view to Kripke, and then I dump on this view, and I say, isn't it amazing that somebody like Kripke could not see the mistakes in his view? But and I think that's all wrong. Like, Stephen Yablo is interesting. He says, he describes this view, this two-dimensional view, and this account of the anti-physicalist argument in Kripke as textbook Kripkeism. This is what we're all taught. And like, I could give you 20 authors who attribute this view to Kripke. Yablo says, I take no view on whether Kripke was a textbook Kripkeism. Interesting. But it seems to me obvious that Kripke could not have been a textbook Kripke. So look, here's the issue. When you have a posteriori necessities, at least one of the terms must not be a million name. Okay, that's the central premise in the two-dimensional argument against physicalism. Now think about what are the two main theses in naming a necessity. One, proper names are million names. Two, proper name identities are a posteriori. The things he says at the end about Hesperus and Phosphorus and explaining the appearance of contingency that might make you think that he's kind of maybe going to be moderating those two claims I just articulated. But in fact, if you look closely at what he says at the end, it's pretty clear he's not moderating those two claims. He's saying something else. And end of digression, one of my little hobby horses. Okay, so here we have one kind of transparency thesis. If you've got 2 million names, then any identities will be a priori transparent to you. Just a comment, so Gregor asked Martina whether her transparency was the same as Paul's transparency, and she said, well, they're pretty different. This transparency, unlike Martina's, is kind of semantic. Martina said it was only nature-revealing concepts that are transparent. Here we have a thesis that in terms of a certain semantic kind, are transparent, brings you closer to Boghossian transparency, but I don't think it's the same thing at all. Here the thesis is that if you have 2 million names, you'll know they co-refer. Boghossian thesis, you have two thoughts with the same content. It's not clear that content is to be thought of in terms of reference here. Then their content identity will be apparent to you. Not really the same thesis. So now we have this kind of transparency. Such semantically direct terms must be epistemologically direct. They must reveal the nature of the identity. Should we believe this? Now, there's a huge literature at this point, and people on the anti-two side start producing counterexamples, terms involving proper names, aren't they semantically direct but not epistemologically revelatory, demonstratives, terms involving recognitional concepts like recognitionally round. And the two-dimensionalists then start saying, no, if we look more carefully, these terms all have primary intentions different from their secondary intentions, and I kind of been in the business myself saying, no, you're kind of reading these terms in a really funny way just in order to defend your thesis. The idea that round is the property that causes a certain kind of experience in me seems a very peculiar account of the recognitional concept round. And that kind of debate was not very productive. And so I'm going to switch to step back a bit and say, look, we're not going to be able to decide this issue by looking at examples. Is there some principled reason why we should believe in two-dimensional transparency? Why we should believe that two directly referring terms must reveal the identity if it's true? And, okay, now, there's not much there. There's not much there in the space for principled defenses is a 2D assumption here. Chalmers sometimes says, look, we really don't want to multiply possibilities, we don't want to allow epistemic possibilities, that Cicero might not be Tully, or Paines might not be C fibers, if they aren't metaphysical possibilities, we don't want two spaces of possibility. It's true you shouldn't multiply entities beyond necessity, but you can't take for granted that this would be beyond necessity. Maybe you need to recognize the epistemic possibilities that don't correspond to any metaphysical possibilities. And I want to say that if you buy into the two-dimensional framework in this respect, there are going to be certain things that you can't explain. In particular, you won't be able to explain happily how there can be two elements of thought, two words in the language of thought, that are distinct, even though they're semantically equivalent. And I mean, at bottom, it seems to me that committing yourself to the two-dimensional framework for elements of thought, and in particular this assumption that terms with all the same semantics must be epistemic revelatory, is just a matter of not taking seriously the language of thought or mental file model of thought. You just don't allow that two elements in thought can be held apart purely syntactically and not semantically. And that's kind of a weird thing to be committed to. I mean, here's an analogy. Suppose you were suspicious of synonyms in a public language. I mean, I can imagine a perspective from which you might be suspicious of that. You might say, look, here are these two words, take your best favorite pair, gorse and furs. And you might say, well, you know, they work exactly the same, all the conventions, they're really the same word. It's just like, you know, the same word being pronounced in two different ways. And not necessarily a crazy thing to say. But if you did that, there'd be some things you couldn't explain. You couldn't explain by a lot of people. Some people are perfectly happy to say gorse has thorns, but deny furs has thorns. And it seems to me that the people who insist on thinking of thought in terms of the two-dimensional possible world framework and nothing more are making that kind of move. But a bit here, just responding to Paul's argument at the end of his talk yesterday. And what I put on the slides is a warning to guard against a certain kind of question begging. And I'll go through that, but in fact I've been thinking more about what Paul says, and I think the disagreement is not that he's begging the question, but he has certain assumptions that I'm denying. So I'd just like to focus on the first one of Paul's argument. His thought was that if you try to refer to the pain directly, kind of in terms of what it's like, as this feeling, what it's like, and it also has a physical essence, which is what the physicalist says, then you're courting the possibility, absurdly, that there might be fool's pain, that there could be something that felt like pain, but wasn't really pain. It had the what it's likeness, but it didn't have the physical essence. Now, at first pass, what the physicalist is going to say, no, I'm not courting that possibility because it's not a possibility. There's only one state. There's no question of the feeling coming apart from the physical property. There's just one property there. There's a physical property, and when you have it, it's like something for you. There's no two properties. Paul wants to say, well, why can't the state come apart from itself? Maybe in the actual world they always go together, but it sure looks metaphysically possible that they should come apart. And that's no good as an argument at this point, because that's just the intuition of distinctness once more, and that's precisely what the physicalist is denying. In fact, after Paul had done that bit, he said, am I begging the question? And then you said some stuff about individuation. And I didn't like the term individuation, but I've been thinking about it more, and it's not an accident that you use that term. And I take it to be a kind of expression of the idea that when I refer to something, I've got to have some extra bit in my head that's not to do with, which is kind of, I've got to present it to me in a certain way. And there's going to be two modes of presentation. So individuation, my beef about it is it runs together the notion of what the state is constituted by, what's its constitution, where for me there's just one thing, and the notion of how do we pick out the state. So sunburn, right? Is it constituted, is it individuated by being a state that's caused by the sun? I mean, and that's a very ambiguous question. Do we pick it out via a description that refers to the sun? Yes. Is it of its nature that it can only be caused by the sun, or can you get sunburned in a tanning studio? Different question. Don't run them together. So watch out for the term. So you're assuming in your term individuation that in order to refer to something, we need a mode of presentation, then appealing to the fact, we've got two modes of presentation, and now you're running the two-dimensional argument. That the physicalist is in trouble if they don't have two modes of presentation, but that's what we deny. We think you don't need no modes of presentation. We agree that phenomenal concepts are direct. We've just got 2 million names. Okay. Not too bad. The last wave of anti-physicalist arguments is pretty different. And this is due to Martina. Where's Martina? Hi, Martina. And after that, Philip Goff. And their move, very nice move, is let's not think of phenomenal concepts as being one case of a special kind of concept directly referring million-time concepts. Let's just focus on phenomenal concepts themselves. And why need we commit ourselves to all this argy-bargy about are all semantically direct terms epistemically direct? Why don't we just focus on the question of whether phenomenal concepts are epistemically direct? Forget about the semantics altogether. There's these very peculiar concepts that all the type B physicalists are trading in. And if we think about them, shouldn't we think that those concepts, when used, will reveal the essence of their reference? And if we allow that, we don't have to say that every term that's semantic direct, that it doesn't refer by description, reveals the essence of its reference. But surely phenomenal concepts reveal the essence of their reference. And that's enough to knock out physicalism, because then you'll have the argument very simple. If experience is physical, phenomenal concepts will show us that they are, but they don't, so they aren't. Just to note, this is another kind of transparency. Phenomenal concepts are transparent. They reveal the essence of their reference. Okay. So now we're going to focus on phenomenal concepts. We don't have to worry about two-dimensional semantics anymore. Of course, somebody like me is going to deny that phenomenal concepts reveal all the essential properties of their reference. We think it's essential, that there's just one state there, as I say, there's just the pain is just one and the same as a property having C fibers firing. But when I think phenomenally, it's not revealed to me that this is C fibers firing. So I deny that phenomenal concepts reveal the nature of their reference, reveal the essence of phenomenal properties. Why should I suppose that they do? There are various things around. I mean, I'm still thinking about Martina's talk and which bit I don't like, and I'm not sure whether the argument she gave today, where exactly it fits into the scheme of things. But here's one argument that's sometimes given in favour of supposing that certain concepts, in particular phenomenal concepts, can reveal the essential properties of the reference. Philip Goff is fond of this analogy. He says, surely reflecting on a concept can tell you about essential properties of the reference. An example he often uses is a circle or a sphere. I have the concept of a sphere. I just need to think about what is a sphere, what is a sphere really, and I'll pull out of that that a sphere is a locus of points equidistant from another point. Yeah, okay, so you might be curious about how certain things can be known a priori in that kind of way. And here's a natural explanation in this case. The concept of a circle or a sphere is a complex concept. It's a concept with articulated elements, and all that's going on when we do this imaginative exercise is drawing out the analytic consequences of the fact that circle is an abbreviation for the concept locus of points equidistant from a point. And if that's what's going on, then I agree that in that kind of case, you can use conceptual reflection to get at the essential properties of some reference. But that's just because that bit of knowledge is a bit of analytic knowledge. And it's not at all clear that this kind of model is going to apply to phenomenal concepts and being able to find out about their physical natures. If physicalism were true, why should I suppose that phenomenal concepts will encode the fact that they refer to physical? And that circle model, I mean, everybody agrees that the paradigm phenomenal concepts are kind of simple and structured, and even if physicalism is true, it just looks crazy to suppose that I'm going to be able to pick out from the concept what it refers to. Somewhat different way of developing, motivating the idea that reflection using a concept can tell you about essential properties is a supposed ability that we have to by just reflecting on experiential yellowness. I mean, you could do it for object yellowness, but experiential yellowness, experiential redness, experiential orangeness, you can reflect, and you will see that yellow is more similar to orange than to red. This is supposed to be an example of an essential feature of these experiential properties. I don't mind the idea that it's an essential feature of these experiential properties, but it's interesting to think about if that's so, how can conceptual reflection get us to these necessary features? Okay, one possibility, so in Julian's talk, we talked a bit about, not quite this case, but how do we know that anything that's crimson is red? And one possibility in these kind of cases is that's another case of analytic knowledge. I mean, this is a kind of Wittgenstein track traces question. Can you define the colors in terms of negation of other colors? Maybe that's what's going on. Or, more plausible in this case, is you're kind of using perceptual imagination to simulate yellow, simulate red, simulate orange, and internally perceive the similarities. And I'm not against that being a way of finding out about these properties of color experiences. But again, this doesn't look like a good model for phenomenal concepts revealing physical natures. Just to put the point, even if physicalism were true, why should I suppose that exercising a phenomenal concept in imagination will kind of show me connections with certain physical properties? It's not quite clear what exercising the physical property in imagination would be, but it's not going to work. So I don't think there's any good model for how reflecting on a concept, why we should suppose it's going to show us about the essential natures of the reflecting on a phenomenal concept. More recently, people have switched. I mean, the same idea that phenomenal concepts are going to be revelatory of all the essential properties of reference, but not exercising phenomenal concepts in reflection and imagination, but rather exercising phenomenal concepts in active introspection. So here I have a pain, it's going on, and I think about it internally, I focus on the pain. Isn't that going to reveal the essential properties? I mean, in fact, it's not quite clear that phenomenal concepts are playing a big role. It's introspection. Introspection is going to reveal the essential properties of the reference. And I'm slightly surprised that when I was doing this talk, I thought I'm taking a bit of a liberty, because what we're all supposed to be talking about is introspection revealing the nature of conscious properties, and I'm only going to be talking about that at the end. But in fact, nobody's talked about that so far, somewhat curiously. Anyway, I think this is the line that Philip Goff now runs in released in his 2017 book. A number of younger philosophers are interested in this. In fact, right now there's a conference going on in Valencia with a bunch of people who are also in this line of business on, I think, introspection, revelation, and consciousness. Anyway, this idea that introspection reveals the essential properties of experiences is going to be enough to knock out physicalism. Once more, we have a simple argument. If experiences were physical, introspection would show this, but it doesn't, so they aren't. Still, why should I suppose that introspection reveals all the essential properties of experiences? Introspection is very good, I'm going to assume. Very interesting question how it does it, but we'll say bits about that in a minute. But, of course, it's highly reliable at telling us what experiences are happening. Not so reliable at telling us what standing states we're having, but conscious experiences is pretty reliable, pretty highly reliable at that. But that's a different claim. Look, perception, external perception, is highly reliable at telling us that something is salt, or something is square, or that it's a cat. I mean, I don't want square, that's not a good example for me, or that it's whiskey. But we don't suppose on that account that external perception is revealing the essence of those things to us. We might be entirely ignorant about the essence of salt or the essence of cats, for that matter. Even though we're very, very good at detecting them. The idea that introspection is not just good at telling us what experience we're having, but what their natures are, is kind of, I think, generated by the thought there isn't anything more to the experience than its non-physical side. There's no physical side to it. I don't want to put it aside that it's not physical. I think that's coming in as motivating the idea that introspection is revelatory. Goff, in his book, has an argument. He has an argument that the revelatoriness of introspection is the best explanation of our being, as he puts it, super reliable and introspectively judging what experiences we're having. Maybe it will play some role in a dualist explanation of our reliability, the revelatoriness of introspection. But it's not to be taken for granted that a physicalist can't also give a different kind of explanation of why we're so reliable in detecting our experiences. And Goff, in fact, recognizes in the book, and he makes various points about the physicalist explanations and his dualist explanation. Remember that the super reliability is just being super reliable at telling what experiences we're having, not what their nature is. So there's a step which Goff tries to bridge in getting from that to the experience, the introspection being revelatory. Is there some support in theories of introspection for the idea that introspection is revelatory? Not obvious to me. I mean, standard theories of introspection, of experiences, break down into causal theories, which are kind of, there's the experience, some causal process, there's the output, I'm having a pain. Not at all clear why the output should tell you about the nature of the state. And acquaintance theories, somehow that you're acquainted with the state when you judge you're in pain, you're acquainted with pain, perhaps the pain is somehow part of your judgment. There's a difficulty on that kind of theory of getting from the fact that you've got the pain right there in you to some kind of articulated judgment that I'm in pain. And the standard way that gap is bridged is to appeal to demonstration. I'm having this experience, this pain, that's what introspection is saying. But of course, demonstration, this is a point Martina made early in her talk, is not the kind of thing that's going to be accompanied by insight into the nature of the thing demonstrated. You might want to argue, look, don't worry about the causal process. I mean, that's an interesting question. What's the mechanism by which introspection works? I think we have direct reason to suppose that introspection is reliable about essences, even if we don't know about the process. Thought Cotty's been pushing at me a bit when I complained about the lack of theory. She said, look, I mean, can't we just see that the introspection is reliable? I mean, I agree that we can just see that introspection is reliable in telling us what experience we're having. But when we look at evidence for introspection being reliable at telling us about the nature of experiences, I think there's quite strong evidence against its reliability at that point. And here I'm drawing on a line of argument that Maya Spaner has been running for some years. She says, look, you really shouldn't think introspection is particularly helpful in finding out about nature experiences, because after all, think about the fact that there's all these really serious, concerned, intelligent, careful, reflective philosophers who've been spending a lot of their lives trying to figure out, say, whether experiences contain non-representational qualia, or whether they're composed of different sensory modalities, or is this just one sensory modality, or do they have rich contents, or do they just have kind of colors and shapes? And they disagree. They're all introspecting and they disagree. So they can't all be right. Introspection cannot be reliable on these matters. Michelle Liu is a young philosopher. She's in fact speaking in Valencia now on these topics. She's written a nice survey article on the issue of whether introspection is revelatory. And she grants these points that, look, on the face of it, introspection is not very good at showing us the essential properties of experiences, citing the Spaner kind of examples. But she says, well, okay, so it's not going to be very good at showing us all the essential properties of experiences, but maybe there's one thing it can show us. Maybe there's one thing it can show us, namely that experiences are not physical. And that's how she ends her survey paper in a Routledge handbook on just this issue. But at this point, I just feel that there's nothing in her arguments, in fact, there's Spaner's kind of counter-argument, nor anywhere else that supports this confidence, apart from the intuitive prior conviction that experiences don't have a physical nature for introspection to reveal. So I think that when we look at the arguments, there turns out to be nothing there except the intuition I started with, that surely, experiences aren't physical. So, okay, that's it. I'm done on time. Whichever way we turn it, there's no good argument against the view that experiences have a physical nature, or at least no arguments that don't start from a prior intuition to that effect. I grant that this intuition is pervasive, it's hard to get rid of half the time, even though I spend my life worrying about these things. I can't help myself thinking that there's two things here. But an intuition isn't an argument, and it's not even evidence against physicism. So I'll stop there.
Retrouvez tous les contenus du Collège de France sur www.college-de-france.fr.